It's the 4th of May, 2016, and may the 4th be with you. Welcome to another edition of Bite Marks Cafe, where we serve you the first bite of today's science and technology. I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ryan Ozawa. We're going to start this hour hearing about a couple of upcoming events. First, Frank Derago from the Maui Economic Development Board will call in to tell us about their upcoming STEM conference and the next Startup Weekend Maui. Then Andy Gosshorn from the Coast Guard will bring us up to date on the MATE ROV Underwater Robotics Competition.
And finally, of course, we'll have Dave Goldko and Norton Chan from the Anui Nui Fisheries Research Center to talk about their coral nursery.
We always welcome your comments and questions as part of the conversation as well. You can contact us by calling in or, of course, sending us a tweet after the break.
And, of course, we want to welcome Frank Derago from the Maui Economic Development Board. And he's here to tell us about a couple of events that are coming up. Hey, Frank, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ryan and Bert. It seems to be our yearly rendezvous just around this time.
Well, you know, Frank, I know there's a lot of things going on over there on Maui, so I would love to see you maybe either come out over here and be a guest in studio, or we'll be more than happy to
talk to you more often.
Talk to you more often and have you tell us what's going on.
I'm going to take you up on that.
Okay.
That's awesome. I really appreciate you guys having me on every time. I have a good time.
Good.
So, let me talk to you a little bit about Startup Week in Maui first. That's going to occur May 13th through 15th. It's a 54-hour frenzy of people getting together who are passionate about business, passionate about their ideas, and get to learn a lot, network, and learn a lot about how to get a business started in that 54-hour period from Friday in the evening till Sunday in the evening. And in one weekend, they'll experience highs, lows, the pressures of, you know, figuring out your value proposition, of figuring out, you know, what your market is, who your customer is, how you finance and how you're going to make money out of this thing, what your distribution systems are. So you learn a lot, but as well as you discover a lot about yourself as an entrepreneur and a business starter. And it should be a great time. You learn it's a very intense experience, but I think everybody that's gone through it, and as you know, in Honolulu, it's a big event as well. This is a worldwide movement, Startup Weekends, that people get a lot out of it.
No, right. This is like your third one? I mean,
our third one. Yes.
Time is moving very fast. Did you do two last year, or was it just one last year and the year before?
We do it one a year. We're a little bit smaller market than Honolulu, but we try to gin up for it every year and get people ready. We actually have pre-events as well. We've got a business model canvas and lean startup overview on May 5th. And Pitch Boot Camp, which will be on May 10th, which teaches people how to make a one-minute elevator pitch. And, you know, I want to send a shout-out to everybody on Oahu who is listening to this. You are totally invited to come over to Maui and be a part of Startup Weekend Maui.
We certainly would love to travel to see that and the tech community as it flourishes over there. So, yeah, last year was the second Startup Weekend. And do you remember what some of the winners were? I mean, just to give us a sense of the kind of ideas coming out of Maui.
Yeah, one was an interesting one. The winner was Board Vote. And what it was a system or an app that allowed smaller boards, nonprofit boards, to be able to vote on issues and discuss issues online. Oftentimes they're not able to make meetings, so this would make it easier. So it was sort of a tiered system based on the kinds of services you would receive as a small nonprofit, but it was tried to be made affordable. It was especially good for homeowners associations condo associations and things like that. And that was the first one. The second one was the second winner was Ticker, I think it was, and it was an app that had to do with a game regarding the stock market.
And they got the popular vote. And my favorite, though, was third place was Pickles, or
Waikapu Pickles, yes. And that's still going. They're actually involved in the Maui Accelerator Program for Food Innovation at UHMC. So before my time runs out, I notice I got 6 minutes going here. I'd like to talk a little bit about our Hawaii STEM Conference, MEDB annually. This is like our eighth year now.
And that's this weekend.
And we've actually from 100 students starting back about 8 or 9 years ago. It was in 2009. We now have over 800 conference attendees, 800, almost 900, 883, about 600 student participants, 113 teachers going through professional development in science, technology, engineering, and math subjects, and 154 industry professionals that participate in this event.
And one of the main organizers is the Women in Tech group, right?
Pardon?
One of the main organizers is the Women in Tech group, right?
Yeah, Women in Technology from Maui Economic Development Board. It's a program. I used to be involved in that before I moved over to business development, actually. It's a great organization, great organizers, and it's a statewide program. We get people and schools. I think we have 125 schools from all over the state participating this year.
So, Frank, you know, this the STEM conference that's coming up, like you said, it's the 8th one. Is it kind of geared, I guess, more for the students, or, I mean, who are the attendees?
The attendees are students, but we have a parallel program operating at the same time, so it's almost a three-ring circus of teacher professional development. So we're taking these same professionals that are doing breakout sessions for the students. They're learning cutting-edge programming and processes. We're also hopefully, I think this year, they're doing a little bit more on entrepreneurship, which is a growing concern and subject, especially starting at the high school level, getting them used to business and the idea of being in business. But it's also professional development going on exactly at the same time that the students are learning, teachers are learning as well.
Mm-hmm. And this is something that what is it that you're looking for as a result of having this conference? I mean, what are some of the, I guess, success metrics?
The success metrics actually is we have what we call the program impact assessment, one thing that STEMWorks does is try to get students involved in high-end technology, but to use that technology as they're learning it at the service of their community. So it's actually a service learning model, as they're actually learning by doing hands-on, but a lot of this high-end technology and development that's going on, coding and all that stuff, is actually being used to produce products at the service of the community. So not only are they learning civic awareness, but they're also learning these high-end technologies, whether it be GIS, whether it be coding, developing websites, graphic design, media, all kinds of media. Those are the outcomes, that they learn these skills, that they become interested in technology, that they start thinking about going to college, especially part of this is also getting them thinking about training, you know, whether it be through badges, things like Dev League, or going to college in computer science or engineering. These are sort of the ends at which we're sort of aiming at this point as a result of this conference. And we have a high incidence of people going through the program who actually do go on to college and are entering into some sort of STEM program.
Mm-hmm. Now, is this like other conferences? Are there keynotes and special guests and such, or is it really more about
exactly? There's keynotes, special guests. I'm trying to remember who the keynote is this year, and I don't have that right in front of me. But we've had some really pretty awesome keynotes over the last years, and some great. Some of the sponsors are Google, Microsoft. Hmm. I mean, we've got some really big heavy hitters. Esri, one of the largest GIS provider softwares in the world, privately owned company. So we've got a lot of heavy hitters. The Office of Naval Research is a backer of us, Air Force Research Laboratory. It can go on. There's a whole list of sponsors for not only the conference, but for the programs MEDB has in science, technology, engineering, and math.
Very good.
So let's go in the order of the calendar. So I believe that this Hawaii STEM Conference, as you mentioned, a statewide event hosted there on Maui, is this weekend? Is that correct?
This weekend, yes. We actually have a pre-event on Friday with elementary school students, and then the conference itself is on the 6th and 7th of May.
Fantastic. And the website, I believe, is the womenintech.com website?
Yes.
All right. And then you mentioned for Startup Weekend, which is next weekend, that there are a couple of pre-events. Can you remind us when those are?
Okay, so tomorrow would be Thursday, May 5th, which would be the Business Model Canvas and the Lean Startup Overview. Mm-hmm. And then the next week is on May 10th, Tuesday, the Pitch Boot Camp, which teaches you how to do a one-minute elevator pitch. And then Startup Weekend itself is from May 13th through the 15th.
Fantastic.
And Frank, is all of this listed on your website? Where can people go to find this?
Yes. It's bit.ly/MauiStartup2016. That's sort of the shortcut.
Sure. We will definitely have that link also for people to find on our show notes for this show at bitemarkscafe.org.
Thanks, Frank, for joining us.
Thank you, guys. I'm always glad to be with you guys.
We'll
Thank
at least talk to you this time next year. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And before, I will take you up on going to Oahu.
Come
okay.
on by.
Come on. Yeah, come on down.
Okay.
All right. Thanks.
Sounds
thanks,
good.
Frank.
Mahalo.
And, of course, next up is Andy Goshorn, and he's with the Coast Guard. He's here to tell us about the Mate ROV competition. And we want to welcome Andy to Bite Marks Cafe.
Bert, Ryan, thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Welcome back, yes.
Now, we had you on earlier this year to talk about the Sea Perch, and Sea Perch is a competition for students to get involved in, which gets an underwater remotely operated vehicle to kind of maneuver a obstacle course. Now, what is Mate ROV?
That's a great question. So Mate ROV takes up where Sea Perch leaves off, where Sea Perch is just focused on quickly building a robot and having it navigate obstacles. Mate ROV is a broader focus that actually ties very well to what our earlier guest was saying, where the student teams come together and they have a CEO, they have a CFO, technicians, engineers, and operators to build an underwater ROV to accomplish tasks. But it's not just the tasks that we're grading them on. Certainly we want to get them to get points mm-hmm. when they recover oil samples from the bottom of the pool, pick up fallen satellites, or pretend that they're sampling the moon of Europa. They also have to get up and give a product presentation to a board of industry specialists from the Pearl Harbor Shipyard, Schmidt Ocean Institute, experts in underwater ROV building, operation. They also have to put together a technical report, which are right now, those all came in last week, and they're being aggressively judged right now by scientists up in the Keck Observatory and across the nation. People are evaluating these tech reports. They'll put together a product display talking about the product they built. So it's not just building a robot and operating. They're actually selling industry a solution to the problem that industry put out there.
I like that. So, I mean, you know, Andy, a lot of robotics contests, they will use a very specific set of tools or even a kit, and they will execute some kind of obstacle course or to achieve a specific thing. But I like that this next level is you are designing something and you need to pitch it as a solution. So I would imagine then for Mate ROV, there's not a Mate ROV kit that you get for $19.95 and start putting something together.
Actually, there is a kit. So the Mate Center does recognize that oftentimes schools, the barrier to entry is getting the right tools and equipment mm-hmm. to start. So there is an off-the-shelf kit that does have the right size propellers and motors to get the teams competitive, but you really can't just – that just gets you the motors and the controller. There's so much more learning that has to go on to actually succeed in the competition. So we like to get those kits out there to help them get their foot in the door, but they can also build their own. And it's awesome to see what students come up with in their own creativity to hit the design solution.
And it also sounds like that it requires a diverse team, not just the mechanical engineers or the people into circuit bending, et cetera, or even, you know, people who are just into aquatic engineering, but you need someone who can do technical writing. You need someone who can do a pitch, it sounds like, even.
You're right, and that's exactly why we love this program so much. It's so holistic in its approach. It's not just the engineering. You know, watching the CEO have to manage a team, it's got leadership, it's got program management, it's got finance and accounting, things that we don't normally talk about in STEM, but anyone who's in the engineering field realizes is just as much a part of engineering as, you know, Pythagorean theorems and fluid dynamics.
Well, you mentioned finance and the CEO. I mean, are those roles, I guess, roles that the students are ready to jump into? How is it that they get a little bit of exposure to what's it like to be the CEO or the finance person for that team?
That's a great question. You know, maybe we'll have to have one of the teams come in and better answer that. we treat the CEOs as the CEOs. When they come and check in, we hold them accountable. We give them the check-in package with their score sheets, and the CEO has to sign after every competition that, yes, or after every mm-hmm. event, this is our robot, that we agreed that was our score. So they're learning very quickly what it's like to be responsible on game day. I can't speak necessarily to the dynamics that happen behind the scenes when they're building the robots, but I got to imagine the teachers are going to use that same model to give those kids the early opportunity to learn.
Now, with C-Perch, that I got the impression was a younger audience where, or a younger, let's say, field of students in the competition. But I, from what I'm hearing, I mean, it's still intermediate school as well as high school. I mean, what is the age group, or is there a difference between C-Perch and Mate ROV?
What I like about Mate ROV is it has three separate classes that we're actually running events for. So it has a scout class, a navigator class, and a ranger class. And each class builds upon the technical expertise from the prior class. So we have teams as young as fourth grade entering this competition. Wow. We also have high school teams. And those are both in the scout class, most basic class. So we can actually bring a diverse group all the way into the entry level. Then as the teams do it a couple of years, they can progress, go to the navigator class, and up to the ranger class.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that the technical papers are currently being reviewed by, aggressively judged. I like that.
From the Keck Observatory
folks. So where is the current state of the current round of competition? What's happening?
So right now, I can't speak to the scores. They're obviously being judged. Mm-hmm. But so the team submitted the reports, and they're finalizing their robots right now. We're finalizing the obstacles. They'll be going to the pool. Like I said, it's a great set of obstacles this year. They're going to be pretending like they're on Europa, so they're going to be sampling underwater vents. They're going to be measuring the ice thickness. They're going to be picking up oil samples. So we're busy finalizing the props for them, getting ready for them to come on board base Honolulu at the end of the on the 14th of May. We're working with Schmidt Ocean Institute, who's going to be there as one of our guest judges. They're going to bring their underwater a display about their underwater ROV that they're building, which is a great segue for the students to see what happens after here. MATE actually got its foundation from the marine industry saying, we don't have enough skilled technicians and operators for our underwater ROV equipment. How can we get students interested in it? Mm-hmm. So this was actually an industry-driven competition to get students focused on careers in the marine industry.
Now, you have a nice facility over at the Coast Guard base over there on Sand Island, but a lot of the schools might not have a pool or might not have the kind of props that would allow them to maybe practice.
Yeah.
What would they do in the absence of that?
That's always a difficult challenge every year, and we always ask our community partners within the other services if there's a way that they can open up other military facilities that might be closer to another school so they could work. So we're always looking for creative ways. I know last for the Sea Perch, I believe the Croc Center Pool allowed some teams to come and practice there. So it's got to be a community event because it's tough for all the teams come to base Honolulu to practice. Mm-hmm. So we try to look for other community mm-hmm. opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Now, the MATE ROV has been going on for how many years? It's relatively new, right?
Well, MATE ROV itself is the competition's going on. This will be the 15th competition. But
in Hawaii?
In Hawaii. So it's been on and off, I think, about 5 or 6 years. There was a break for a few years. Mm-hmm. This will be the second year I've run it here on Oahu. And Hilo just wrapped up their competition last week.
So this is all coming to a head soon, but certainly a fair question to ask. And certainly, I think you asked my daughter, unfortunately she's graduating, but if a school or a student was interested in getting into MATE ROV, do they start with Sea Perch? Is there a path for someone who's not involved with the program?
That's a great question. I think either Sea Perch or MATE are both great ways to start. It all depends on kind of what your technical level and comfort is. Both programs have their strengths and weaknesses. If I had to choose one, I'm probably more partial to MATE, only because it allows more growth within the competition. Sea Perch is a little less holistic. It's a little bit simpler, but Sea Perch is also great if your teacher and your students have no idea. They just have to solder a few joints, and they can be up and running, whereas MATE requires soldering, a technical report. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit steeper of a learning curve.
Mm-hmm. Is there a place online they can go or contact locally that they can look for?
Absolutely.
Teacher, for example.
So the overall MATE website is marinetech.org. And then and from there, you can click through the regional links to find the Oahu website.
Okay. Very
fantastic.
Good. Now, Andy, we want to thank you so much for all that you've done for Sea Perch and MATE ROV and, just really kind of bringing the whole underwater robotics competition to everybody's attention. And I really appreciate you coming on the radio and joining us.
We love it.
Thank you so much, guys. I couldn't do it without you guys' support. I really appreciate how the community's really supported us and allowed just gotten the word out. And every year we've grown. Last year we had 7 teams. This year we have 18. So we've already doubled from last year, and that's just on word of mouth. And as you know, it's the community, it's the teachers, it's the mentors being willing to say, "I don't know the first thing about robotics, but hey, we'll give it a try." They'll use the resources that the Mate Center puts out to learn, and that's what helps these kids succeed to answer tomorrow's problems.
Great. Well, congratulations on your success.
And of course, we'll take a short break right now, and we'll return with our friends from the Anuenue Fisheries Research Center, Dave Goko and Norton Chan, to talk about coral nurseries.
What are some of the strategies they're exploring for saving our reefs? Of course, we'd love your thoughts or questions as part of that conversation. You can give us a call at 941-3689. That works toll-free from the neighbor islands with 877-941-3689.
And of course, we're live in the studio. You can tweet us your questions at Bite Marks or at Hawaii. This is Bite Marks Cafe.
Turns out that thinking like a computer doesn't necessarily make you a robot.
Surprisingly, there's actually a lot that we can learn from computer science about making better decisions in our own daily lives.
I'm Kai Rizdal. What you can learn from algorithms in real life. We'll have the numbers from Wall Street and the rest of the day's business news next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6, following Bite Marks Cafe.
Family kitchen table will soon be an interactive device.
It's a touchscreen display. Up to 5 people can use it at a time. You can research recipes from there. You can check your email. In the morning, you can have your coffee and you can read the news.
The Kitchen of the Future. I'm Sarah McConnell. Join me for With Good Reason. Thursdays at 6:30 on Hawaii Public Radio.
Support for Bite Marks Cafe comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Straub Clinic and Hospital and Gourmet Events Hawaii.
Welcome back to Bite Marks Cafe. I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ryan Ozawa.
And joining us today are Dave Goko and Norton Chan. Dave is the director of the Coral Reef CSI Field Training Program and the manager. Is that right?
Yeah.
Close enough.
You should read the
business card. And the manager of the coral nursery at the Anuenue Fisheries Research Center.
Norton, meanwhile, is a coral nursery specialist at the coral nursery.
And, of course, you know, they didn't give us cards until right now. So
sure, that's what it is.
Yeah. But, of course, what prompted the need for a coral nursery? I want to answer that question. Of course, we'd love to hear your questions and comments. That number to call is 941-3689 on Oahu or 877-941-3689 from the neighbor islands. We want to welcome you both to Bite Marks Cafe.
Well, Thanks. Thank you for having us.
Dave, I want to start with you because, you know, I was really actually quite fascinated by the fact that there was this coral nursery on San Island. And a friend of ours kind of introduced me to Norton, so I got a chance to come out and visit. But I got the strong impression that this is relatively new and something that I wouldn't have known about if it was, you know, if I had sought this out maybe a couple of years ago. So what transpired in the last couple of years that got this started?
So our coral restoration nursery is new. It just opened a couple months ago, mm-hmm. But it's been in the making for a couple years. And as most of your listeners know, corals around the world are in decline, serious decline, due to global warming, coral disease, and a lot of man-made issues over fishing, sedimentation, coastal development, et cetera. And wherever you go in the world, we're seeing less and less reef. Now, Hawaii is very, very unique, and most of us who've grown up here know that. But in terms of our coral reefs, about 22 to 25% of the coral species that are in Hawaii occur nowhere else in the world. And that means we have no replacement pool for these corals. Mm. So if you go to a place like the Great Barrier Reef, there's a lot more species of corals, but those species occur in a lot of different places. So if you trash a part of the barrier reef, you can always go somewhere else, get some of those corals, bring them in, and recreate that area given the right technology. Mm-hmm. In Hawaii, we have no other place to go, so we have to take care of what we have here. We have a problem, though, in that because we're so far north of the equator, coral reefs here grow slower than they do almost anywhere else on the planet. And that slow growth means that whenever we have an incident, like a sewage spill, a vessel grounding, a molasses spill in a harbor,
mm-hmm.
the time that it takes for those corals to recover isn't measured in years, it's decades.
Is it so? Is that a matter of metabolism or temperature specifically that makes that difference for our species of coral?
Exactly. Because we're so far north, our waters are cooler, our corals have evolved to grow very slowly and to live in this environment. And because of that slow growth, it's not a lot of techniques that are used elsewhere in the world to deal with corals, such as in-water coral nurseries, really don't work that well here because it takes so long to recover. Mm-hmm. And that's what made us start looking into ways that we could fast grow corals. And that's kind of the focus of our coral restoration nursery. It's to fast grow these corals.
So I'm actually quite impressed by the fact that somebody recognized this need and actually was successful at getting some funding to actually start up this nursery. Can you tell me a little bit about whose brainchild that was? You said a couple of years ago you guys were working on, you recognize the fact that all the coral is being impacted. I mean, we've done articles about, and I've seen articles about coral bleaching. You know, and was it difficult to, let's say, and maybe I should remind everybody that this is, you know, you're part of DLNR and a division of aquatic resources. You would have to have gone to the legislature, right, to get monies to actually start this up.
And to be honest, actually, we didn't.
Oh, okay.
And what this came out of was over the last 10 years or so, actually went back even farther than that, go back almost 16 years ago, mm-hmm. there was an incident on Kauai at Pila'a where a car dealer who was developing land over there caused a bunch of sediment to kill off that reef. And that was like the first big event in recent history where an entire reef was heavily impacted. And at that time, we didn't have any tools. We kind of went and looked at the damage, and we were scratching our heads trying to figure out what to do. And over the ensuing years, we've had three of the largest ship groundings in U.S. history to impact coral reefs occurred right off of Oahu. We've had major sewage spills. We had the molasses spill in Honolulu Harbor. A number of these incidents have killed off large sections of our reef. And with each of these incidents, we started thinking about, well, we talk with the responsible party. We try to get them to come up with a way of making things right. But we never seem to go back and try to restore and repair mm-hmm. the damaged areas. Mm-hmm. And because our coral reefs take so long to grow here and are so slow to recover, we needed a way of dealing with this. And so, as I said, about 2-3 years ago, we started to focus. After a major ship grounding, we had some money from the responsible party. We said, what if we try to actually build something for the state, by the state, to directly address this problem? And mm-hmm. that's what got the ball rolling.
I certainly am impressed that it's essentially a DLNR kind of operation, and that we saw that need that it was invested in, perhaps because we had this unusual funding source, unfortunate funding source, to get something started. But the idea of a coral nursery is fascinating to me. I mean, because we know that coral bleaching is a global concern, and I know there's research happening all around the world, are there other examples, Norton, of coral nurseries specifically? Is this a thing in terms of aquatic or marine life nurseries in general, or are coral nurseries fairly novel?
Coral nurseries actually occur throughout the coastal areas. But for Hawaii, this is our first one that's actually state-run and the first one probably in the state at all.
Are you taking, you know, insights and working with your counterparts in other coastal areas?
Definitely. We have seen other results from other facilities, and by applying what we can to our facility and learning a little bit more, we can actually be a little bit more successful. But like Dave said earlier, our corals are a little bit unique, so we have to tweak a little bit to match our corals here to be able to grow them better.
Mm-hmm. You know, we actually had a question posed to us from a shy engineer, and wanted to find out, you know, as far as corals go, being that we are in a cooler area, and of course there's more corals in warmer waters, are there, let's say, if you were going further up north, what's the coral population like, let's say, closer to Alaska or, you know, way up in the North Pole? Is there...
You'd probably be talking about the northwestern Hawaiian Islands, where the water is generally a little bit cooler than here. And so the coral there is a little bit less in terms of the types of coral.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit slower growing, too. Mm-hmm. So definitely if you're here in the main Hawaiian Islands, the coral seems to grow a little bit faster, but there's different species also up there in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands.
Well, you know, if you're not as shy as our engineer, you can feel free to give us a call. The number is 941-3689 on Oahu or 877-941-3689 from the neighbor islands.
We're also listening on Twitter.
Yes, definitely. And we're talking to Norton Chan and Dave Goku from the Anuenue Fisheries Research Center and talking about the coral nursery there.
Now, Norton, you talked about, or you've both mentioned, sort of this longer cycle. Hawaii's corals take longer, cooler water. So although the nursery is only 2 months old, what does this operation look like? Do you have, you know, grow lights to try to get them to grow faster? Are you putting a little extra something in the water? I mean,
yeah, we actually do have a little bit of a secret there. We actually have a room where we actually have a controlled environment for the corals. So optimal temperature is actually closer to 80 degrees. So our normal surface temperature waters here run about 77, 78, which is a little bit cooler. So if we actually have the temperatures a little bit warmer, they'll be able to grow faster. And also the corals are in a room that have controlled lighting. So our lighting is constant and it's on for a certain photo period. So they get the maximum amount of lighting too.
No one's going to step on them?
Nope, nobody's going to step on them.
Fish aren't going to pick
them. Yeah, we actually have fish in there too, but they're actually herbivores to keep down the algae. So we do have a setup where we control the lights, we control the water temperature, and even the water chemistry. So we actually make the water too for the corals in there.
So, David, what does it take to start a coral nursery? I mean, do you find an unhealthy coral reef and find some polyps there and say, here, we've got a nice new home where you can be happy? Or how does that work?
Well, here's the problem. As I was saying earlier, we don't have a lot of coral in Hawaii. And what we have grows really slowly. So the concept of where do you get your coral from is a big issue if you're in an area that doesn't have a lot of coral. Most of it's right next to shore because our islands come right up from the ocean bottom. And the result is we've had to come up with some kind of innovative ways. It's not appropriate for me to go off of Ala Moana Beach, for example, and take coral from there to move to an area off of the airport, robbing Peter to pay Paul approach. Mm-hmm. That doesn't work in an area when we have so little coral. So what we've realized is, and this came about a number of years ago, that some of our harbors have a lot of coral in them. And they're actually a pretty good source of coral. They're growing on man-made structures in the harbors. And in the harbors, they're not serving a lot of the ecological services and functions that corals on a reef do. For example, the same coral of the same size, same species on a coral reef in Hawaii is actually serving to protect us from wave action, protecting our coastlines, creating sand, serving as a wide variety of homes and services for fish and other small invertebrates. In the harbor, it's not doing that. It's serving very few functions. So as a source of coral, it's a great source of coral without impacting our natural reefs. But there's problems with taking things from harbors. Our harbors have a lot of invasive species in them. And harbors over decades have been sources of heavy metals and pollution from the various activities in the harbors that could be incorporated into the coral skeletons. And right. If we were to just move those corals out onto a reef, we would be exposing them to pollution and heavy metals and possibly invasive species that they currently are not exposed to.
Now, do you know if there's even an impact on the operation of the corals themselves? Are they like secret Spider-Man, X-Men, mutant corals?
Well, we have found through some of the work that we're doing that some of the corals in the harbors are extremely resistant to temperature and sedimentation and certain pollutants. And appear to have over time been selected for this. Mm-hmm. But the other species of corals that we've been collecting, we bring them into the nursery. As Norton was explaining, we have this special room after they go through a proper evaluation in the field. And then when we bring them into the nursery, they're in quarantine for a month or more. And during that time, they're carefully watched. And then we fragment them. We remove everything except for the coral tissue and a little bit of the underlying skeleton. And in this manner, we're able to minimize the pollutants, the heavy metals, and the invasive species so that as we grow these corals, and that's the key, in this room we're fast-growing corals. In the wild, corals in Hawaii grow at about a centimeter a year. That's a fraction of an inch. In the nursery, we're able to, with the techniques that we're using, grow them at 4 to 5, 6 times that rate, which means you can make a really big coral in a fraction of the time it takes to take to occur naturally. And why is that important is whether you're a human being, a bird, a dog, a fish, or a tree or a plant, there is a certain size at which you are best capable of surviving on your own in the wild. That's called a size refuge. And we know what it is for most animals and for most plants. It's at that point where you switch from putting all your energy into growth to putting some of your energy into sexual reproduction. And if we can get the corals to those sizes, we have a lot of confidence that they'll be able to survive when we put them out and transplant them out onto our natural reefs.
Very good. You know, we're talking to Dave Goku and Norton Chan from the Anui Nui Fisheries Research Center and about the coral nurseries and the nursery that they have built out over there. And, of course, if you have a question or comment about coral nurseries and sort of the condition of condition of corals in our reefs, give us a call. Number is 941-3689 on Oahu or 877-941-3689 from the neighbor islands. We want to welcome Kevin from Pacific Heights. So welcome to Bite Marks Cafe.
Good afternoon, and thanks for all the work you're doing, gentlemen. My question is, given the fact that we've had some recent warmer waters or coral bleaching last summer, for example, that did recover, but it's a little scary what's going to happen this year as well. Is there any consideration of introducing some species that would do better in a little warmer water, perhaps faster growing, and sort of creating more of a mix of coral so that can withstand these temperature variables?
Great question, Kevin. Yeah, good. So, Dave, you want to take that on?
Sure. So, in Hawaii, as I said earlier, about 22 to 25% of our species, our coral species, are unique to Hawaii. That's the highest you'll find anywhere in the world. It's called endemism, and it's what makes one of the things that makes our reefs unique. It's one of the things that makes Hawaii unique. The problem with that is that these species have arisen in an environment where there's very little competition. So if you bring in species from other places that might be more resistant to warming, or to other effects of climate change, they'll probably be able to outcompete a lot of our native species, and there's a risk of an extinction event for a number of these species that occur nowhere else in the world. So we would probably not entertain bringing in outside species into Hawaii. What we would try to do is look at ways that we can either minimize other effects to provide those corals with the best possible chance of surviving those temperature changes, or looking at ways that we might be able to make those organisms a little bit more resistant. I will mention one of the things that the Coral Restoration Nursery has done is we've taken a little bit of space at the nursery and we've created a coral ark. It's a series of tanks where we are maintaining almost like a seed bank of a wide variety of the unique and rare coral species that occur in Hawaii in case something does happen to these species in the wild.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, I mean, because my a fair question, if not a slightly depressing question, would be, isn't it possible that the environment of Hawaii's waters would change to the extent where our native corals simply won't be able to persist? I mean, they would persist further north where the water is still cold, but would we kind of, is it possible that we might just lose them for where we are, especially given human activity in the water?
Very much so. But we have some unique advantages here. One is our extreme isolation, which is both what resulted in these unique species, but also may provide them more of a balance against some of these changes. Also, because the waters get so deep here, you don't only have to go north to get cooler water. You just have to go down. And so it's possible that our corals could extend or survive increasingly warm water as those species can extend deeper into the water. The problem with going deeper is you lose the light.
Right.
The other thing I would note is change has occurred in Hawaii over the millennia that the islands have existed, and it's the rate of change that will determine whether these corals survive or not, not the change itself.
Mm. You know, I do want to kind of continue the question about what types of corals would you want to grow in the nursery? And perhaps, you know, to the caller's question, are you able to select ones that perhaps are in the environment that they are more resilient to the temperature changes? But before we go to that, I want to hold that thought. We'll be right back after this short break to continue our conversation with Dave Goku and Norton Chan about the coral nursery over there at the Anui Nui Fisheries Research Center.
We'd, of course, love to hear from you. You can give us a call as well at 941-3689 or reach us toll-free from the neighbor islands at 877-941-3689. You are listening to Bite Marks Cafe.
We live in Hakalau, which is a tiny little village 16 miles north of Hilo.
And there's absolutely, we don't have high-speed anything. There's no cable TV. So radio is our lifeline. We absolutely live for HPR. We listen throughout the day without fail.
Member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Radio with vision. Listen and see.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Isabel Allende is a consummate storyteller and author of many novels. Next time on New Dimensions, she talks with Michael Toms about writing and the deeply moving story of her daughter's death.
Sunday morning at 11. Support for Bite Marks Cafe comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Nohea Gallery and Kaiser Permanente.
Welcome back. This is Bite Marks Cafe. I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ryan Ozawa, and we're talking to Dave Goku and Norton Chan about strategies for saving coral reefs.
And of course, you can give us a call and ask us your questions at 941-3689 on Oahu or 877-941-3689 from the neighbor islands. Right before the break, we were kind of talking about some strategies on which corals would you want to select for your nursery that may exhibit some, more temperature resilience. Norton, I mean, what are you, when you go out there and select your corals, are you looking for any particular trait?
We're not looking for a particular trait in the corals themselves. We're looking for the size of the corals, and we're looking for corals that are actually common reef-building corals that you can find on the reef. So in terms of temperature, we're not looking for that. But being that they're Hawaiian corals, they're all being exposed to the same temperature. We would hope that what we bring in will be fragged and be formulated into a larger colony, and when they go back, will still be able to survive because they're from the same environment.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'm kind of still stuck on our former caller's question. Certainly, it makes sense that we wouldn't transplant more warm water, stronger, more aggressive corals, perhaps, to our environment. We certainly have learned, hopefully learned lessons from past experiences bringing in
like
outside
mongooses.
Species. That could be one. But, Dave, what's to stop some of these happy in warmer water, faster-growing corals from around the world from coming here and sort of overrunning our indigenous local corals?
Well, corals don't swim. They're hard, stony corals. They're called that for a reason, because they're attached onto the bottom. And they grow up, they have to be attached to a hard substrate. The only time they can actually move about for most of the species is when they're larvae, when they're really tiny, almost microscopic swimming larvae. And then, you know, they're that small, you can only swim so far. In addition, the way that most corals are thought to have gotten to Hawaii, other than long-lived larvae, is what's called rafting, attaching onto things that are floating like tree logs or pumice, the lava that comes out of a volcano that has a lot of air in it that can float, these floating rocks, corals can attach onto it. And as that moves in the currents, that's how some of these things got here.
Well,
in today's world, though, you can transplant corals. It is illegal to bring corals into the state of Hawaii, but you can buy corals on the web. And we're very concerned about people illegally bringing in corals. It's also possible they could attach onto man-made objects, ship hulls and things like that, on slow-moving ships and come in that way. But
well, with the Fukushima disaster in Japan and all of the debris that was released into the ocean, it was making the news every time a boat or a random piece of large object floating ashore in Hawaii, and many of them would be teeming with sea life.
Exactly. And my agency, along with some of our partner state and federal agencies, have put amazing amounts of resources into both monitoring these debris fields as they move around the Pacific, but especially as they come into nearshore waters, having response teams that go out to assess the debris. In some cases, vessel hulls. We had one come ashore last week, actually, to look at what's growing on it, what threats it might pose, and how we would mitigate or minimize any invasions that might come with the debris.
Well, then and there's also the gyre that's, you know, out there, all this debris field. And there have been studies, I think, over at the Hawaii Institute for Marine Biology. I mean, they actually looked at this this fish, which actually kind of jumped on the gyre and took a ride, and actually is now hybridizing and changing the population here, you know, in Hawaii. So that could easily, if that happens with a fish, I mean, it could easily happen with coral, I would think.
It can happen with coral if the coral can attach to something to slowly grow as that moves with the currents. I think one of our bigger concerns is, as I said, illegal introduction or coming in on man-made structures, slow-moving barges, oil derricks, things like that that might move around and be moved here purposely. The bigger issue, though, is that coral is a natural part of our Hawaiian marine ecosystem. It plays an extremely important function, not just in terms of our reefs, but I said that 22 to 25% of the corals are unique. Well, about 25% of our fish species, our algal, our limu species, a wide variety of our invertebrates are also unique, and they're dependent upon those unique corals that exist here. So as the corals go, so do the rest of our reefs and our nearshore marine ecosystems. So the state views this as an extremely important function for us to try to not only maintain our reefs, but to restore those that we can as a way of balancing out the effects of climate change and especially the man-made effects that are occurring both locally and from outside Hawaii.
We're talking to Dave Golko and Norton Chan from the Coral Nursery over at Anui Nui Fisheries Research Center. And if you have any questions or comments, feel free to give us a call, 941-3689 on Oahu or 877-941-3689 from the neighbor islands. We want to welcome Darren from Kuli'o'o to Bite Marks Cafe. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, aloha, guys. I was wondering, you talked about man-made structures in the negative sense, ships, debris, things like that. In a way that theoretically wouldn't harm any surf spots, why or are we as a state looking into man-made structures like reef scaffolding and as opposed to just like dropping more ships, you know, wreck diving and things like that that grow coral, but intensely putting out in barren zones around our islands habitat?
That's a great question. And Norton, I mean, you are experimenting with some growing platforms or platforms upon which coral might attach. Maybe you can talk to this caller's question.
Sure. I think I'm not exactly sure what he was referring to. He was sounding like he was talking about making more artificial reefs. But what we're doing is actually making modules of for corals to actually be built on. So we're looking for smaller size 40-centimeter modules that we're going to be putting on the reef itself. So in terms of sinking ships for diving, that's something a little bit different from what we're doing now.
So, but in terms of the caller's question, I mean, do you think that building structures in the ocean would satisfy, let's say, you know, encourage the population of corals to grow?
Perhaps. I think that if you have a barren area, definitely things will settle onto it. So you would have things growing there.
Dave?
One of the issues with Hawaii is Hawaii's got what are considered relatively low relief reefs, meaning the corals that occur on our reefs are rather close to the bottom. What that has the effect of doing is spreading our fish and things like lobsters and stuff over a very wide area because there's not a lot of high three-dimensional structure for them to shelter in. When you build an artificial reef, that tends to have a higher three-dimensional structure. And one of the things we've noticed with artificial reefs around the Hawaiian Islands is they tend to congregate fish. And that was the purpose for them. When my division created them, it was to enhance fishing. But one of the non-expected results of that is they tend to pull those off of our low-relief reefs and concentrate them on high relief. So with the artificial reef program, we've moved towards moving those reefs farther away from the shore, farther away from natural coral reefs. And what we're talking about doing with the Coral Restoration Nursery is not creating new large man-made structures, but growing corals and rebuilding our natural reefs with those corals.
Well, I'm glad you clarified that because, yeah, I was a little confused. So, but what you were saying was that with these larger three-dimensional structures, they actually pull the fish resources from the you know, the regular coral out to those three-dimensional.
They have a much better view. They're just that much more attractive to the coral.
And so they don't really contribute to the population growth. They actually are like moving from one apartment to another.
if those structures are placed close to our reefs. Yes. So one of the things we've been doing is trying to place our reefs in areas where there are no coral reefs, artificial reefs in places where there are no coral reefs, where they'll have the maximum effect of both enhancing fishing and providing shelter for a wide variety of organisms. Now, one of the things we may use corals from the coral restoration nursery for is enhancing these artificial reef structures to give them even greater biodiversity, greater range of fish and things that can live on them by putting some of our grown corals out onto these structures.
Well, Norton, I want to talk a little bit about that transplant process or that step, that great moment where the nursery has been successful. Because, you know, whether I liked what Dave said about sort of the having the right size, being at the right point of their life cycle. But when it comes to any sort of nursery setup to try to encourage a species in the wild, there's always the concern that either one, they won't be ready or prepared for the real world, or two, that they might be too successful in some way when reintroduced to the natural environment. I mean, how are you prepared for that or watching for either of those possibilities?
Well, I would love it to be too successful at first. But by having the corals at our nursery, we're actually slowly acclimating them as they come into our nursery to go into our fast growth protocol area. And as they get bigger and they form, we actually move them back out, so we acclimate them again. So as they re-aggregate back into the larger modules, we're acclimating them to our environments that we're going to be putting them back into. Like on a reef, if there's like a high surge or high wave energy area, we'd actually simulate the environment a little bit and then try to get them back out there.
It just occurred to me, maybe I didn't fully understand. I mean, certainly when we're talking about any species bred in captivity that has never had experience in the wild, that's one thing. But you're not doing coral spawning and sexual reproduction in the lab. You're bringing some in, strengthening them, and then returning them.
Yeah, so we're actually bringing in a smaller piece of coral. And in the end product, after a while, we're hopefully having a few larger colonies to be able to put back.
I see.
Now, I want to get to the, you know, what you've already learned, some best practices, how you accelerating their growth. We have another caller, Mike from Kaneohe. Welcome to Bite Marks Cafe.
Hi there. I was just wondering if when you select corals from the reef to bring them into captivity, if you'd considered or were looking at during their spawning time when they do sexually reproduce, looking at some of the larvae and growing those or rearing those larvae in a simulated elevated temperature, and looking to see if there's any gene expression to maybe select for corals that are tolerant to high heat, since we are entering such a time of elevated temperatures in the ocean, and maybe rearing some of those corals to then put back out later that are, again, more heat tolerant.
All right. Great. Thanks for your call.
Great question, Mike.
Yeah, that's a pretty good question. We're actually not spawning corals right now. So to actually get corals to spawn, we actually have to wait for them to spawn in the wild. So we don't have that opportunity every time to be able to get the coral spawns. So maybe two or three times a year, you'll actually have that opportunity. Right now, we're actually taking corals that are from the harbors and of a certain size and bring them in to the nursery and then working with them there. So in terms of looking for corals that are more resistant to temperature, that's not the main purpose
right
now. So
we're not quite at the spawning. And
I believe, HIMB is actually doing that right now.
Right,
too.
Yeah. So Ruth Gates over at the Hawaii Institute for Marine Biology, I mean, they're actually looking for corals that are more, let's say, temperature tolerant, and then trying to get them to reproduce inside the laboratory.
So they're looking a little long term. Mm-hmm, we're looking immediate. They're more immediate short term, trying to get more corals on the reef.
So Norton, I mean, have you started to actually place some of the corals that you've grown in your nursery out into some of the areas that you want to try to repopulate?
Well, like Dave said earlier, we just opened up
2 months.
Oh, two months.
So
I mean,
we don't have a whole lot of stuff yet. So we're still in the forming stage. We're getting corals in our facility, and we're actually going to be putting a little bit of them outside right in the harbor. That's as far as we're at right now, and hopefully in the next few months we'll get more, we'll be able to put some outside.
Are you seeing the accelerated or better growth in this environment that you were expecting when starting the coral nursery?
It's actually much faster than what we had planned on. And I think an important point to think about is – think about a coral about the size of a large flat-screen TV, okay? A coral that size in Hawaii probably took hundreds of years to get to that size. So this is an animal that's been around for a couple hundred years. And up until now, you can't replace 100-year-old coral in less than 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
But with this technology that we're incorporating, we're hopeful that we can actually put out corals that normally would take decades, 20 years to occur naturally on a reef. We're hoping to get out in 1 year, which gives us a huge jump on trying to repair a lot of the reefs. And I do want your listeners to understand that we hear every day about climate change and the horrible effects it's having worldwide on coral reefs. What we need to understand in Hawaii, we're surrounded by very deep water. Yes, the waters are getting a little warmer, but most of the impacts on our reefs are locally caused.
Hmm.
Okay, we have very little coral reef, and it's right next to shore, and we're in a highly urbanized environment. Mm-hmm. So, pollution, nutrients coming off the land, sewage, mm-hmm. injection wells, ship groundings, coastal development, overfishing, all of these things are putting tremendous strains on our reef. Now, one way we can do that is through control of human behavior. That's, we have regulations and we try to set up marine protected areas and things like that to try to allow some of our reefs to survive. We're also trying to attempt to help repair some of that damage that humans have caused locally in our reefs through this coral restoration nursery.
Mm-hmm. So, Norton, I mean, what's in the Miracle-Gro formula that you have discovered that gets them to grow in 1 year that would have took one decade?
There is no set formula necessarily, but by fragging the corals into smaller pieces, so we have a larger colony, say 10 centimeters, and we're able to cut the corals down into smaller sizes, they tend to grow faster at that size. So if we actually have a large plate, we can actually put several plugs of them on them and they start spreading faster. So by doing that and having the environment that they're in, the tanks, the temperature, the water chemistry, the light photoperiod, it enhances everything. Mm-hmm. So they grow faster.
Mm-hmm.
So, Norton, you said you're just at the point, only 2 months in, where you might start moving them outside of your facility. How far is the next milestone? How far until your corals are back in their forever home?
Back in their forever home, probably end of the year, maybe, would be the first ones, or the beginning of next year.
Well, that's a pretty good accomplishment.
That's what I'm hoping for.
Is there a particular area that regionally that you're looking to reinforce first?
Yeah.
Well, places we want to reinforce first, to try to give them the maximum benefit, are areas that have been impacted, but areas that also have some level of protection. So some of our marine protected areas where there have been major impacts, and some areas that aren't formally marine protected areas but are de facto marine protected areas because of their unique locations, either associated with some sort of security zone or some other sort of regulation that limits other types of human activities that might affect these organisms.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Now, we'll put the show, the link to the Anui Nui Fisheries Research Center up on our show notes later on today. And, of course, we want to thank both Dave Goko, who is the manager, and, of course, Norton Chan, and he's the coral specialist over at the Anui Nui Research Center and the coral nursery. We want to thank you both for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having us today.
Thank you very much.
Great conversation. And thank you for listening to Bite Marks Cafe. Join us next week when we talk about frozen space rocks.
And, of course, if you miss any edition of this podcast or this show, you can listen to the podcast on bitemarkscafe.org. And, of course, if you have any comments or suggestions, you can email us at feedback@bitemarks.org. You can also find us on Twitter. I'm at Bite Marks.
And you can follow me at Hawaii. Our engineer is David Chong. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And, of course, we leave you with our song pick of the week. Here is May the 4th Be With You.
Of course.
And, of course, Star Wars Binary Sunset. See you next week on another edition of Bite Marks Cafe.